and welcome to this episode of the ABCs of Green Politics. I'm Saoirse McHugh and I'm joined by my co-hosts John Barry, Lorna Bogue and Sinead Mercier, and we've been joined today by Fergal Anderson from PolitBio, farmer and co-founder of PolitBio, which is Ireland's only member of the Via Campesina. Thanks as always to Brian from Grooves Ahead for making us sound coherent and clean and non-staticky. He's brilliant. And I suppose we'll just get right into it. And Fergal, welcome. Thank you for talking to us this evening.
I'm always happy to talk about food and farming, Saoirse, so it's a pleasure.
Great. So I suppose to get things going, I was just wondering if we could start kind of briefly looking at the Green Revolution, primarily mm-hmm. because I think my favourite quote in the whole world was from, or one of them was from William S. Goad, his name was. He was a US like administrator for USAID at the time. And he said that, and I've written it down to make sure I don't misquote him. When talking about the Green Revolution, he said, it's not a violent red revolution like that of the Soviets, nor is it a white revolution like that of the Shah of Iran. I call it a green revolution. So he coined the term. And I suppose to stop me talking, Fergal, would you like to just tell everyone what the Green Revolution is?
Well, I don't know if I am qualified to answer that question, to be perfectly honest about it. I mean, I suppose the Via Campesina used to talk a lot about the Green Revolution, and when we worked on international food policy and like, you know, there around the WTO or around the Food and Agricultural Organization, it was often something that was spoken about more as a historical kind of process which had nearly ended than one which was ongoing, because they were really talking about a new green revolution at the moment for Africa and things like that. So I suppose what I understand when I heard about the Green Revolution is the kind of the application of, I suppose, industrial inputs and industrial, you know, production systems to food production, while also a kind of a parallel to that, the kind of expansion of the global market in trading in agricultural produce. And like, I mean, that's tied into lots of different things, and I suppose key to it is the international trade in goods, because I mean, food and agriculture has always been traded, I suppose, between countries, and I think what you begin to see after the Second World War is the kind of the recognition that there's going to be some capacity among the larger, more productive states to be able to kind of control the flows of, you know, commodity crops across global markets. And like, I mean, I said, I'm not an expert in this. I'm a farmer myself, but I mean, I see this as part of the process of the historical development of agriculture and food production internationally. And like, I mean, what it has led us to is a situation where we have a minority of crops which are grown internationally, and most people are eating a kind of minority of crops. You have, you know, the application of industrial production methods to the production of most of those commodity crops. And everything's generally focused around the grains. I mean, the cereal production, you know, rice and wheat, corn, and some pulses like soya. And those are the big commodity crops internationally. They're the ones that we currently, I suppose, that we've been traded on the Chicago Exchange. I suppose what's happened in that time, and it's very hard to paint these massive brushstrokes, because I think, you know, it's been different in every country and in every place. But I suppose internationally, the situation we're in now is the first step along the road to where we find ourselves at the moment, I suppose. But like I said, I think every country has its own history. And I'm more interested in what's happened in Ireland. And I think we've had our very own, very specific kind of experience of agricultural development, which doesn't always mirror the ones that they've had in other countries around the world. So I think it's interesting to look at that. And I suppose, I mean, our Green Revolution probably came when we joined the European Union, because, I mean, that was when we really began to modernize agricultural production and really began to look at how we could kind of, I suppose, apply those sort of modern techniques and modern farming systems to what were essentially quite, I don't know, I don't like the word undeveloped or underdeveloped, because it sort of implies that some development needs to happen, but some sort of less commercialized farming models, maybe. Not which I'm romanticizing either, because I mean, a lot of people would have grown up on those farms and would regard that as kind of a a time of poverty and difficulty, and there's no lie about that either. But I mean, I think, we're moving in a different time now. I mean, John, I see that you've got input there, or I don't know. I've just opened up so much there. I don't know where to start or end.
No, I think, Fergal, you've laid it out very well. And I mean, for me, the Green Revolution was always about getting rid of the sin of Malthusianism. You know, this kind of ghost that's been haunting the green movement and issues around food for centuries is that, you know, human population growth is going to outstrip our capacity to feed ourselves. And of course, we can't, you know, have this discussion, and maybe we can get into it later on. You know, Ungerthe Moore has been an omnipresent socio-psychological issue in our society alongside colonialism, and they are connected with the land and food. But certainly the Green Revolution is, as Fergal said, you know, the application of chemicals, the fixing of nitrogen, which is incredibly carbon intensive, very polluting. But it is about increasing food production, and not necessarily food security. It's about actually increasing food production to be then globally sold. I mean, Fergal is quite right in terms of identifying this as the point in which, you know, food, if it ever was a human right, it absolutely, after the Green Revolution, after the Second World War, becomes a commodity. And there's investment and speculative investment that flows into this. But it's sold, you know, the one that I know most familiarly from teaching is India. India was one of the first test countries in the world for the Green Revolution, you know, extending these new crops and so on. And again, as Fergal pointed out, these were kind of miracle crops in a way. They could grow in arid soils, but the reality was they were a reduction in the pluralism and variety of crops that were available once. But also then it meant that farmers were then locked into contracts, often with foreign, you know, agri-food systems. And the last point I'd make is that, you know, in many respects, the Green Revolution is the point at which agriculture becomes agribusiness. And therein lies a lot of the problems, including with the European Union. You know, in terms of when Ireland enters the EEC in you know, the early 70s, and we get locked into CAP, I think it taps into that pent-up desire of a proportion of our farming community to see access to new markets, subsidised food. But actually, it's all based upon carbon. It's all based upon chemicals. It's all based on externalising the cost of food production to the land, or indeed to, you know, human communities and so on, and pollution. But also then I think it's around, you know, this commercialisation that creeps in where, we, you know, food now becomes absolutely a high value commodity. Because just to finish, in the way the Green Revolution points out that we may live in a post-industrial society, but unless we can synthesize protein from rocks, we're never going to live in a post-food society. So it's a very valuable commodity and industry, because human beings are always going to need food.
And well, because I have no problem with painting in large brushstrokes and being melodramatic, I do think, like, what I kind of like about, or not like about it, but what I always find so intriguing about the Green Revolution is, like, in that quote, it seems, and reading about it, it seems like the US was using it as a tool to battle, you know, scary communism. And it was very much so about making sure that these countries were, like, the very basis of what a, you know, what a society needs, which is food, is integrated into these national markets and can't disentangle themselves. And they were so successful in those regards. It always strikes me that, like, our whole food system now, like Fergal was saying, in some way or another came from that sort of thinking. And yet, like, we've never revised it, even though we're not scared. Well, some of us aren't scared of the Reds under the bed anymore.
It's a global food system. I mean, it's a global system that dances to the tune of the capitalist market, essentially. I think that's the, you know, sorry to interrupt you there.
I suppose, like, in terms of Ireland, because it does seem, and I think people do think, like, so often, sure, you've seen it yourself all the time, there's this idea that Ireland is somehow exempt from that globalised food system. Like, we don't like talking about the fact that most of our food, most of the things produced in Ireland are exported. And we kind of hate that idea, because it doesn't sit well with our, you know, nice stone walls, and aren't we so, you know, traditional and rural Ireland. We watch the greyhounds and whatever else we do in rural Ireland, apparently. And we don't like thinking about the fact that we are just as much a part of that as anyone else.
I think there's a reason for that, though, and it's something I've thought about a lot, because I've been trying to work out why we have this attitude. And I think it's a cultural thing. And I mean, John touched on it briefly earlier about the Gortamore. But I mean, our experience of the land within the last 200 years has come out of that colonial experience of being under, you know, part of a global empire, probably the most, you know, vicious that we've seen in recent history. And we have to remember that, like, if the only memory of the land that we have, the only cultural kind of construction of, that we have, the only understanding that we have of the land is built around this idea that we just need to get it and to survive. That's the first lesson that we get from it, is that because we see, you know, we don't have access to it. It's owned by large landowners. If we can get a bit of it and we can survive from it, that's already a great achievement. And the other lesson that we see is that the land is just exploited, because that's what the British would have done, is they'd have used the land as best they could to take as much off it as they can. We don't really have that third lesson, which is the lesson that comes from, I suppose, a security of tenure and a kind of, you know, generations of being able to kind of make a living and make a kind of build a culture around the land, which is to kind of take care of it and nurture it for the future and recognize it as something which can kind of provide for us, you know, long term in a much more, you know, sort of solid way than you know, trinkets like money. And so, like, I think that cultural kind of basis is I wouldn't say it's missing in Ireland. There's little pockets or little elements of it around, but I can understand that why we've ended up with that culture of exploitation or survival and missed out a little bit on that kind of, I suppose, the continuity of like a longer term culture.
Yeah, no, it's just interesting because, you know, my granddad would have been a farmer as well. And he's like one of the first in his family to actually go to college. So he went to the agricultural college. So we have all of these like red notebooks, like with the really, you know, beautiful sort of cursive hand in it. But it's funny because, or interesting, because like, I suppose I wouldn't know too much about growing anyway, if my poor beetroot or anything to go by there. We were having a chat earlier about our plants, and I put my beetroot in before it snowed, and then it snowed on them. So it took them like, they're only starting to come up now, but like, I'm not sure what's beetroot and what's weeds. So it's all just like a big disaster. So that, you know, that's how little sort of I would know about,
be patient,
you know,
be patient,
growing things, or...
Yeah. Be patient.
This episode brought to you by Brown Envelope Seeds. I'm just trying to get some free seeds here. I think going back to that idea of, you know, the Green Revolution, but what came before it, and, you know, we do have this memory or this sort of cultural memory, whether it's, you know, like necessarily the case or not, of, you know, what came before, you know, was subsistence farming. Like that's the name that's generally put on it. But like the interesting thing about subsistence is like, it's another one of those kind of words that tends to get misunderstood a lot. So subsistence is kind of very much heavily associated with poverty. But then like, if you actually look at like the etymology of the word itself, like it means substance or stability. And I think that's kind of, maybe that's kind of the difference or the change that happened there, because you know, like you'd often sort of hear of like, you know, a farm that could have one cow on it, and that was subsistence farming. And you know what people were doing was that they were farming, you know, to feed their families, and then they weren't really necessarily sort of you know, like exporting it so much or selling it, like maybe some of the surplus, but like generally, if you were in places like County Clare, for example, like the first kind of capitalists in rural Ireland were actually women, because they were the ones who had the hens. So they had the hen money, and they could actually go, and they had the surplus value that they could actually, you know, bring in like, you know, discretionary income and stuff like that. And that's, it's just funny, because like, it's something that I learned about in my Irish music and dance degree as well, where it was kind of like the reason why concertinas are like so prominent in Clare, for example, is because women were the ones who had the money. So they liked that particular instrument because it was small and dainty and they could actually, you know, like, you know, learn to play it. So like if you're kind of around East Clare and places like that, like it's all women concertina players. And that's kind of where that sort of came from. So, I mean, that's all just kind of like a very big, long and whimsical and possibly a historical kind of ramble there. But I'm just kind of wondering, you know, like going back to that idea of, you know, the you know, what happened kind of before the Green Revolution and like what happened in Ireland. Like, you know, Fergal, you were sort of saying that you were more interested in Ireland and the Green Revolution. So do you want to kind of maybe educate me a bit about that, or kind of what kind of developed there?
Yeah, again, I don't know if I'm qualified because I'm sure there's people who've done PhDs and all this stuff. And all I have is, you know, I suppose what I've read myself. But I mean, when we talk about Ireland and the Green Revolution was what you were asking there, wasn't it? Yeah.
Well, yeah, because it seems to have come a lot later here.
Yeah, well, that seems, yeah. So like, I mean, Ireland... And there's been good work done in this, like, you know, in terms of trying to sort of frame Irish food production and try and understand what was going on exactly and how we ended up in the situation where we're exporting 90% of our beef and dairy or whatever it is or more, you know. And like, I think Ireland must have always had a bit of a propensity for exploitation as well, but certainly extraction, if we imagine an empire, would have looked at Ireland as a breadbasket, a source of a place that you could get food to feed its own urban population. So I think we've always had this sense that we were producing for somewhere else as much as for ourselves. And I mean, I'd be very careful about not over romanticizing kind of pre 19th century kind of farming in Ireland, where like land was very much at a premium and there were a lot more people around than there were today. And I'm sure there were lots of farms which were nice and had a kind of, you know, a little bit of an income, but there was also a lot of poverty, I think, and a lot of hard times and a lack of land and a lack of tenure, like absolutely, because people weren't even allowed to own land. Or so like, I mean, Ireland, and I always used to have to explain this to European colleagues in Brussels, that our history is so completely different than most of the rest of Europe in terms of like our land struggles, our struggle for independence, you know, our relationship with our major neighbour, which wasn't ever a relationship of kind of like, you know, mutual interest, let's call it, you know. So like, I suppose if our history of agricultural production has always been based around this kind of exporting or extraction, I think the Irish state, when it formed, had a choice perhaps to sort of see, okay, well, maybe it didn't have a choice because economically it was in a very difficult position at the time, but to say, well, what do we do and how do we develop the land and how do we develop our agricultural sector? And of course they're going to try and sell as much as they could to whoever would buy it off them, I think. And like, I mean, the decision to join the EU, I mean, almost 50 years after independence, would have also been born out of the idea that like there was space for modernization in the Irish agricultural sector, that we could probably produce more, that we could probably export more, that there were cooperatives and businesses that were involved in the export trade that thought they could make lots more money. And like, I mean, I suppose since the formation of the state, I don't think there's been a, you know, I don't know, maybe I could be corrected on this, I'm sure, if I'm wrong, but like a kind of coherent government policy, which has looked at the land of Ireland and said, okay, well, how can we best use this for the people that live here in terms of the production of food or fuel or fibre? How can we create long-term kind of, you know, sort of, I hate the word sustainable as well, because I think it's kind of been used to death now, but, you know, sustainable livelihoods or livelihoods which can kind of be maintained long-term on the land, you know, and create that culture that I was talking about before, which is a culture of kind of care for the land, you know, which, and it doesn't look at it just as something that we can kind of exploit short-term for and maximize gains. And I think that's the situation we're a little bit stuck in now, is that we have this kind of very short-term attitude when really we've never needed at any point in human history a kind of long-term view. And like, that's what the peasant farming has, is a long-term view, because it doesn't see time as a straight line. It sees it as a circle, because, you know, if it's every action is unfinished. So if you're planting trees or raising animals, you're never finished doing, there's always more work. So there's always more, the time is always looping back. So, I mean, I think there's an awful lot we can learn, you know, from those cultures, but there, as I said, it's unfortunate that we've kind of probably eliminated most of them in Ireland, or there's very little of it left. and that maybe we need to rebuild a new culture around it and create a whole new set of kind of understandings and look at, you know, who's on the ground today doing things. And that's a little bit what we're trying to do with Talib Bio, is to explore, you know, what is happening in terms of like land use and the ground in Ireland. What are people doing, and how can we kind of build a culture around that, which is, you know, puts land at the center.
Mm. And can you talk a bit more about what Talib Bio is? Because, you know, everyone's heard of the IFA and the ICMSA and the ICSA and the INHFA. So can you just talk a bit more about Talib Bio?
Yeah, I mean, Talib Bio is both an attempt to fill a gap and a kind of also an attempt to open up a space, if that makes sense. So we formed Talib Bio because we thought there was a missing voice in the whole narrative around food and farming in Ireland and food production and agriculture. And I mean, the farming organizations in Ireland, the big farming organizations like the IFA, have been in some ways extraordinarily successful at achieving, you know, what they've achieved, you know, and have created a kind of system which works very well for a very small minority. But they've completely missed the boat when it comes to talking about that kind of long-term, I suppose, social, economic, environmental, you know, resilience or sustainability, again, that can mm-hmm. actually kind of create livelihoods from the land. And so we said with Talib Bio, what we need to do is organize as people who are actually involved in food and agricultural production directly. So not as you know, groups of experts or an NGO or well-meaning individuals or whatever, but as people who have a kind of are doing it as their profession and have a, you know, that vested interest, I suppose, in representing themselves more along the lines of a union than as a, you know, a lobby group. But I mean, so I suppose we're trying to fill that gap that we think is of something that's not there, and also trying to sort of say, well, there's a missing piece of the picture, and we might be it. And I think what we hope to do is to open up the space for things to happen, because I mean, there's nobody talking about food sovereignty in Ireland before Talib Bio came along. There's nobody talking about kind of, you know, agrarian politics from the kind of perspective that I think we're bringing to it, or trying to bring to it. And like, I think even if they're not going to turn around and implement all the things we'd like to see happen, it might open up, or it might create more space for good things to happen. And we can see already kind of the winds of change beginning to blow a little bit in terms of like this pressure coming from all sides onto the Irish state at the moment, from its own citizenry and from the European Commission and from lots of groups, you know. And I think, yeah, something has to shift. But it's yeah. I suppose it's Talib Bio is an attempt to help try and shift things along a little bit.
Because it does feel like, you know, there's pressure from the EU. It feels like there's pressure from people. It feels like there's pressure from farmers. It, like, the land is under severe pressure. Like, it feels like.
Something has to give.
Yeah.
Something has to give.
I mean, it feels like it's beyond time. Something has to give. Like,
yeah, I mean, I wonder, I think, you know, since the formation of the state, we've had these two political parties in power, you know, and like, we still have them, one or the other. You know, it's always been Fianna Fáil, Fine Gael. And like, they both are very wrapped up in those farming organizations and in the whole kind of, and I mean, I fear that there's no real chance to break that, you know, control, unless, you know, we break that sort of, you know, break open that sort of system of those two parties. But I mean, it will be incremental for now, I think. I mean, I don't know if we can change it all overnight. And the other thing, I suppose, with farming is that it takes time anyway. And this is the thing that's so frustrating, because it can take 20 years or 30 years to change farming systems, just because it takes a long time to bring in new things and to change a culture. It takes a long time. And that's why, you know, it's frustrating, because there's things that could have been started 15 or 20 years ago that would have had a great impact now that haven't been done. And so, like, if we're not doing them now, and because nobody wants to do anything that's not going to be any use in 3 or 4 years' time. You know what I mean? They want to see a short term response. But I mean, we need things that, you know, people look back in 20 years and go, oh, that was a good program, or that was a good idea, or this was a good, you know, it might take that long to see results, you know.
That's like that agrarian politics. As one of these very well-meaning people, obviously who knows shag all about, about farming. And I'm happy enough to admit that. But you know that idea of an agrarian politics is really interesting. Like, what do you kind of mean by that? Like, what specifically like does that look like in practice? Apart from getting the pikes from the thatch, you know that's kind of agrarian politics there.
Yeah, I think agrarian politics has never really died out completely in Ireland, and you still see it in lots of different. I mean, there's certainly a hotbed of it in the kind of. It's not always articulated particularly well. It's not always kind of shown out, you know. And people, it seems like ignorant and crazy, but like, I mean, the beef protests of last year or 2 years ago, it is now a good example of it. I mean. They were on the streets of Dublin. They spent the night up in Dublin, waited outside until the minister would come out and talk to them. You know what I mean? All night long. You know what I mean? With their tractors. So like, it's not always articulated in a way that we might kind of be familiar with, or it might not seem to us as being the most, you know, coherent, and it can be difficult to get a handle on and understand where it's coming from. But there is a kind of agitation there. And like, I mean, I heard somebody say around that time, they said, oh, look, a lot of these farmers are just, you know, I've come to a point where they have their mortgages paid, right? And they're sick of kind of, you know, still participating in this sort of rotten system where they know they're getting ripped off. They know who's ripping them off. They've been ripping them off for like 30 years. But now they're in an economic position where they can actually say, you know, I'm not going to sell my beef to the factory for, you know, 6 months because, or a year, whatever it is, because they're boycotting the factories, like, and so like that's agrarian politics too, and it's of a different shade, I suppose, than Tadhg Beo, because I mean, I don't know if they're, and I think it's part of the issue with movements like that, is that maybe they're not critiquing the whole system as well as they should be, and I think if they could take a few steps back and say, look, we don't want to be part of a commodity generating, you know, factory system. Like, and I was going to mention earlier, there's this idea of comparative advantage, you know, which is also the kind of foundation stones of the global trade system. And essentially what they've said in Ireland is that your comparative advantage is that you can grow ryegrass, and you can grow a lot of ryegrass. Mm. And with that ryegrass, you're going to create beef and dairy powder, and you're going to export it. And you know, the farmers that are in the beef plan movement need to say, we don't want to participate in your commodity production system. We don't want to be part of that. As opposed to saying, I want a better share of that. And that's where I see the kind of the issue in that agrarian politics is that it's saying, give me a bigger piece of the pie, as opposed to saying, that pie, you can take that pie and you can that pie out the window. And that's what, I mean, I'd be like to say with Tadhg Beo is to say, look, we don't want that system of land use in Ireland. And that's where you're putting yourself up against the likes of the big beef processors and the big agribusiness corporations. And that's where you're factoring. That's where the real vested interests are. That's where the interests are. Like, they're locked into the Irish state in a way which I don't think any other. Maybe the cement industry, but maybe that, you know. But like even deeper and longer, they've been locked in there. So like, I mean, breaking that cycle, that's going to be tough. But I think we can make marginal gains around the edges, and that's already something. If we can begin to revitalize local food production, if we can begin to, you know, encourage farmers to change the way they farm, even if the produce is still going out into the global market, you know, we can do it in a way which isn't, you know, creating a commodity at the expense of our own natural environment. It isn't polluting our watersheds. It isn't killing off our biodiversity and eradicating habitat. That's a minimum. I mean, I would regard that as a minimum, as a responsibility of the Department of Agriculture, is to ensure that any production that happens here doesn't have a detrimental effect on the Irish population's living space. I mean, you'd think that's pretty basic stuff, but it's not when you're up against that kind of embedded powers and the powers that be. So I don't know.
Yeah, it's hard. It's hard to know though, because I mean, it sounds like an issue that all radical politics has, you know, where, you know, because like, I suppose, you know, in a context where I'd be more comfortable in, it's a bit like, you know, working in a call center and saying, well, you know, screw capitalism, like, join me, comrades, like, let us hang up the phones and throw them out, throw the computers out. And it's hard to say that to a group of people when you're so precarious in terms of your own financial situation that you are forced into a scenario yeah. where the demands become, oh, well, you know, if we just got paid better, or, you know, if we had more pizza Fridays, that would be nice, which is usually what we'd end up sort of settling for.
But that's a little bit the situation. I mean, a lot of farmers, you know, who are in the conventional system probably feel that they feel stuck, I think. And they don't, there's not much agency when you're there. You have one outlet for your produce. You have, you know, you take the price that's given to you. And that's also what's been, you're being told by your agricultural advisors and your, and I've been to those Chagas options meetings for farmers where they say, you can do nothing about the price. All you can do is maximize your production per hectare. That's all you can do. So if they're telling you that, you know, on the ground, and they're, and you go, and, you know, and they're offering you the, you know, the stacks of fertilizers, et cetera, et cetera. So, like, I mean, and they're saying that that's how you go about it. I mean, of course, we're going to end up with detrimental impacts around us. I mean, if that's the only route that they're offering, there's only one road, you know?
Yeah, it's true enough. And like the meat processors, like the sort of power that they have in towns in Ireland as well is just, it's unreal. Like, it's just absolutely unreal. Like, and it's kind of, their stranglehold is, you know, sort of like price is kind of the only stranglehold they have now. But I you know, the way it used to be was that, like, you know, because like my granddad, for example, like he was producing beef and then at night he was going and working in the processing, you know, and like that. And then he was stealing the beef to take home to feed people. Like, so, it, you know, there's just these really sort of exploitative sort of things, and it's hard to break out of them, I think.
Well, I just give one last point, because I see there's some people walking in there, but the other thing I just say is, well, there is this massive transfer of money every year. So there's the CAP, the Common Agricultural Policy, and I was doing some sums on it last week, because we were discussing it a little bit, and between all the different schemes, and I'm including the environmental schemes and Pillar 1, Pillar 2, according to my calculations, it was 1.7 billion euros, okay, transferred essentially from the taxpayer. And that's European money too, but, you know, that's the transfer. And I mean, we have to, everyone thinks, oh, the farmer's getting loads of money. Now, there's two things. One, that, you know, there's a huge problem with the distribution of payments and who gets what, etc. And two, the input costs. So, like, I mean, most of the time, that subsidy is essentially paying for contractors, fertilizers, diesel, all the inputs, feeds, okay? So they've taken a farming system which essentially could be almost zero input in a perfect world, and they're essentially subsidizing the inputs to that. So, like, I mean, if you think about that transfer, it's actually a public transfer of money, not to a private individual, but to the businesses that provide the inputs to the farming system. But, yeah, just thought I'd mention that. It's one other thing, a little bugbear.
Maybe if I could just come in terms of, you know, it's interesting. I've been a university lecturer for over 30 years, and the thing that gets students going in class is not global justice or even the planetary crisis, but whenever I raise issues of food, and particularly around meat eating, it's amazing how food really gets to the quick, because it's something we have to do every day, and most of us don't really think much about it, but actually it's an amazingly useful tool to explain the world. Where's your food come from? Under what conditions was it produced? And it's awful to think that in advanced societies such as ours, the complete ignorance of most of our citizens about the conditions of production in particular, and not realizing horrible things, never mind the externalizing. You know, we mentioned price here, but of course, price that we're talking about here does not include the health of the farmer, the stress on the farmer, the pollution of our rivers. All these are externalized in our contemporary market system. I mean, it's an awful statistic that apart from, I think, firefighters and I think maybe in the building construction sector, there's the highest rates of, you know, health and safety and suicides are amongst our agricultural workers and, you know, and so on. And it's something we've kind of sequestered away in a, you know, the similar way that we don't see how our meat is made. You know, abattoirs don't have glass walls. In the same way, we don't understand fully the ultimate costs of production in terms of our you know, our food. But it does seem to me that there's something about learning from the past. I mean, most of us in Ireland are not that far removed from the land. I mean, I'm the token dub, I think, here on the call tonight. But, you know, my own family's only three generations away. That, you know, we often think that we're so far removed from the land that we've got no connection with it. But actually, it's, you know, we're not that far removed. And there were sustainable traditions in Ireland that I've only recently become aware of. You might know more about Fergal. You know, some of us in the green movement and green politics have heard about Eleanor Ostrom and the Commons and so on. Well, Irish peasant farmers were extremely sophisticated in preventing what's called the metabolic rift of nutrients from one part of agricultural production being exported out. You know, it was called the Rundale system, a very sophisticated way in which peasant farmers in the west of Ireland were able to commonly agree rotation of crops, of ruminant animals and so on. And we often think of the past as this terrible place. And don't get me wrong, the horrible crap went on, homophobic, sexist, and we're still living with the legacy of that. But actually, there was a wisdom in the way people were connected with the land. And I think there's something we can learn from that without, of course, romanticising it, and so on. But it does seem to me that there's something in our current moment around our importance of recognizing that food is absolutely essential to life. You know, we cannot have, as I mentioned earlier, a post-food society. Food is absolutely, you know, a key aspect of what it means to live in a, you know, a good society. But we've completely exploited the land and those who produce the food. You know, we've used mechanization, we've used chemicalization, industrial processes to reduce the number of people working on the land. And I think if nothing else, you know, it's a shame on the green movement for not making this a valid issue. And you're right, Fergal, to point out that there's often an urban elitist looking down on the farming community. And then when they make protests, and we forget, of course, that decolonization and the liberation of Ireland from Britain, or depending on your view, the partial liberation, actually began with the peasants, the land league, you know, in terms of that essential element of a peasant society that was used as a breadbasket. And we were deliberately deindustrialized by Britain, except for the northeast, up where I live in Northern Ireland, that our legacy is as a, you know, an export basket. The way Russia treated the Ukraine, Britain treated Ireland, we were a source of cows to be exported, uneven rendered and so on. And Sinead might want to talk about the wonderful work of Conor McCabe, who's done a lot of analysis of the way in which the early Irish state effectively said, we're going to export our people to Britain. And particularly in the post-war period, a lot of Irish people got jobs in the health service and construction and so on. And then we exported, you know, our cattle. And in fact, the people and the cattle often went together in the same ship. So that's just me about teeing up Sinead to talk about Conor McCabe, who we have to definitely get on the podcast at some point.
You're very kind, John. You should really be doing it yourself. But yes, for sure, it'd be great to get Conor McCabe on. And it's fascinating listening to you, Fergal. I just keep thinking, because I'm a dub as well, like John. I came from the north inner city. And we moved out to Connemara, to Inchiaharua, when I was about 10. And it's fascinating because I'm here in County Clare now. And just when I worked in the Greens and when I worked in the environmental movement, I never really understood kind of there was this real anger against kind of, I'm not supposed to anger, I suppose the different conceptions of land really, really strike me. So when we're here in Clare, it's kind of, in Connemara, basically, the land is more or less held in common. It's really interesting. And I never realised at the time that was actually quite unique. So, You know, for example, if we want to go to the beach or if we want to, you know, go for a walk, we would just kind of walk across people's fields. And now that's obviously because the land is kind of and the farming and the cattle is done in a very different way. And very, I mean, the biodiversity is fantastic, despite there being quite a number of cattle. But I suppose it's not the same as maybe what I'm seeing in parts of Clare, or, you know, what family of mine who live in Wexford and so on would tell me, that you know you wouldn't be allowed to kind of access a certain piece of land that, and there's an awful lot of cattle on it. And yeah, it's just kind of it's just fascinating, because I do think, as you're saying, that kind of rural agrarianism and that kind of what Hilary Tovey calls that kind of rural populism and agrarian kind of protest is still very strong. And that idea that the land is held in perpetuity, it's there for other generations, it's there to be handed down. And like this, it's interesting how close it is to the language as well. I think that might be part of it as well, that you're protecting, it's a conservation of the language. It's like a protection of the language, the stone walls, the kind of the beautiful vernacular kind of housing, as well as tied in with the forms of agriculture. And I'm not saying this in a romanticized kind of manner, like, because I do find that interesting. You know, you obviously get a lot of other blue-ins who would move to the area, and the romanticization, you know, is generally kind of trying to use people's culture, or trying to take from it as a totem for yourself or for self-aggrandization. But I just find that really fascinating, and I think it is alive. I think it is very strong. And having lived there and having these like lovely kind of people as my neighbours, and even the way the Irish language as well kind of has that very, and Monica Mongan talks about this a lot, has that very kind of environmentalist, well, environmentalist is probably the wrong word, but certainly kind of ecological way of thinking, that your language, your practices and your way of life will be more in keeping with how the planet itself naturally works. And this is something that James Scott calls metis, or local knowing, that why isn't that as valued as maybe the kind of more technologies of the Enlightenment, or like that kind of day-to-day understanding of the environment and the land around us isn't maybe as valued as kind of a very strict technological or scientific understanding of nature or agricultural practices. I hope, yeah.
That's actually something we've talked about in Talib Beo, yeah. That very issue. In terms of the expertise, because, I mean, ultimately... And I'm a blow-in myself, but I should say, just as a freedom of information there, essentially, to where I am. But but that idea that the people being on the land should give you the best idea of what's going on it, and the best understanding of it. And that essentially, this been kind of a transfer of expertise to the likes of Chagask advisors, or, you know, there's been a kind of I don't know how to describe that, but I mean, farmers haven't been encouraged to kind of look at their land as something that they need to understand themselves. They've been told this is the recipe for how to get more out of it, but not as a kind of a deeper understanding of it. And I mean, the experts should be the people who live there. You should be, if it's your land, you should know it better than anybody else. And you do probably know it better than anybody else. But at the same time, you wouldn't be encouraged to think that, I think, by the existing system. And I know, you know, farmers around me who would question their own instincts nearly, you know, because might have been told something different, or be, you know, nearly be encouraged to think that they're thick. You know what I mean? Whereas really it's just lack of, for the very reason that you're saying there, it's like a lack of kind of, they probably know best what it needs and have been watching it, you know, for many, many years, and know how it will respond to different things. So it's, yeah, that's interesting that you mentioned that. I think it'd be interesting to see a kind of a better appraisal. And it's what we're kind of do a little bit with Talib Beo, is to sort of say, look, you know, let's put the faith a little bit back into the people who are on the land, because there are people out there who've got a very good understanding of what needs to happen, and we should trust them with it a little bit, you know. But there's also other people as well, and I'm not discounting the agrarian populace amongst it, who, you know, some people just want to grind it down and take whatever they can off it. Like, and that's just, there's people who own land in Ireland who do not give a hoot about what happens to it. And that's a problem as well. And so, like, I mean, I this is where the bigger question of where is the role of the state and how far can we, at what point do you stand in and say, well, hang on, you can't do this anymore. I mean, you can't do that because it doesn't really belong to you, even though you think it does. And I mean, this is, if I'm coming from a agrarian radical perspective of saying, I don't think the land should really belong to any of us, because ultimately, you know, the whole idea of private property, like, you know, and land ownership for me is questionable, especially when if you're into any kind of form of real environmentalism or talking about the land or the world as a kind of, you know, self-regulating organism or whatever it might be, the idea of private ownership is absurd, really, you know. So, I mean, I think we're a long way from that in Ireland, because we've embraced the kind of neoliberal model so deeply and profoundly and so wholeheartedly in nearly every aspect of our lives that farming is just another aspect that has been, fits very, very nicely into that at the moment. And I think we can see all the reasons, all the results of that in our farming systems the way they are now too.
Fergie, you kind of just got into it there. I was just going to say, and like, geez, I'll be cancelled for this, but is there not sometimes a bit of the whole, the kind of noble savage idea when we talk sometimes about like, who knows best about the land? Because as Fergie said, like, I look at some people that farm and I'm like, wow, that looks dreadful. Like, wow, you've like killed this entire river. Congratulations. And you have destroyed everything. And now the soil is unusable and it's like compacted and there's nothing but rushes everywhere that you just have to spray every year. So like, yes, I think some people who own land or who have land do, you know, come to a compassionate understanding of the land, but a lot of people just don't care. Or maybe it's unfair to say they don't care, but they have come to a point, their situation has brought them to a point where they can't afford to care. And also, I think it has been weaponized in Ireland, this idea that the only people who should be able to talk about land are the people who own loads of land. Where you get people in cities and towns who are like, oh, geez, I'd kind of like if we didn't destroy everything and it'd be nice if we had water. And everyone's like, well, you don't own the land. And people kind of get afraid of talking about it. But like, you know, it's like 114, where it was 10 years ago or whenever I calculated this out, there's something along the lines of like €114 per person paid into CAP. So that's all of us. And, you know, yes, we have a Ministry of Agriculture, and it's quite remarkable that we have, if you just look at dairy farming alone, there's like 16,000 dairy farms in this country, say 8,000 of them are big. And like, we have a whole department whose sole job is like to put that above everything else, above clean water, above fairness, above so much else. And so, like, yes, I think, of course, you know, farmers do have a role to play, but I feel sometimes that's weaponized by like Danone and Ornua, who are like, you have to listen to the farmers, and the farmers say they want more money to put nitrogen into the rivers. And you're like, but is that true? And like, I think I get what you're saying, but it just feels, especially in Ireland, like the whole debate around it can be so toxic. It's like sometimes the way it's talked about, it's like the only people who should have any say are people who are lucky enough to own land. And
I
was just going to say, there was a report out today and it's like, land prices are at the highest ever since 2008. And I was like, oh, marvelous. Great. I would never own land.
I agree. I mean, I agree absolutely with what you're saying there. And I think urban people are essentially dispossessed. I mean, I think that, you know, how should I put this? It's in every citizen's interest that we use the land better in Ireland. And I don't think we should listen to all the farmers. I think we should listen to the farmers that have a critique of the existing system, that have, you know, from an economic and social perspective as well, because I mean that's a key argument that's often left at the side of, you know, behind the economic ones and the environmental ones. But I don't even where to start with that. I mean, I agree with you, and I don't agree with the idea that land is a, you know, you can only become a farmer if you inherit land, or if you can, you know, if you're in the system already. It's very difficult for people to become a farmer, even if they want to, if they're coming at it without land. How do you get land? Land doesn't transfer quickly in Ireland. It's one of the land is extremely expensive in Ireland. And in the reasons for these, we could talk about for ages. And like, you know, there is the historical reason that, you know, we didn't have land and now we have land. Everyone wants to hang on to it for as long as possible and do whatever they want with it. But they're not excuses. There's a difference between a reason and an excuse. And it's not an excuse for us to do nothing about it. So, like, I mean, there's certainly arguments to have kind of new laws based around sort of access to land for people. And certainly to stop the concentration of agricultural land. Because, I mean, this is one of the things that will happen in the next 15 years. You're going to see every townland in the country go from having 15 or 20 farmers to having five. And when that happens, because of just the aging farming demographics, and it's just going to happen. And like, I mean, it'll happen very quickly. And that farmland needs to be put into some sort of preferential buyer option, like a preemptive buy option for new entrants or for people with agroecological farming plans. So the Irish government needs to step into the land market for, you know, since they dissolved the Land Commission, and basically say, well, maybe we need a new land commission, which begins to say all this land is going to become available. We're not just going to allow the farms to disappear. We're going to try and retain a little bit of the structure of the farming systems in, you know, and try and make sure they're farmed in an agroecological way. But those are huge. They're big steps. They're big. I mean, they're from where we are now with, like I said, the kind of this neoliberal model. It seems a long way to imagine that they're going to rebuild the land commission to address some of those issues. But it's been done in other countries, and like there's countries in Europe which have a much better legislation around land protection than we do. And actually, we're very badly prepared, even when it comes in terms of agricultural leases, long-term leases, for example. If you want to lease land on a long-term basis, you don't have no right of renewal. You've got, you know, you have very limited things you can do with the land. So you have, you know, you can be turfed off it. Why would you bother doing anything productive with it, really, in the short, you know, in the long term? So there's so many angles that need to be resolved. And like, I mean, it can seem overwhelming, but that's why I suppose Talib Bew, and I didn't say this earlier, but like, I mean, we're a farmer led organization, but it's open to citizens as well. And we have to work out within the organization how we build an organization of farmers and citizens, because there is this, I suppose, a tendency to kind of have come from different perspectives and like, you know, and have different experiences. But I think it's in those conversations that we might be able to build something quite special. And that's the kind of the social movement that I'm thinking of that we need to build is going to have both those voices. It can't just be the farmers against the state or the citizens against the state. It has to be the farmers and the citizens together somehow to break down that kind of control that exists there. And that's a long-term project. You know, if we get halfway there before I'm an old man, we might be lucky, you know. But we have to start somewhere. I guess that's the other thing. Well, I suppose it's important before, is that to recognize our place.
Yeah. Well, I mean, like those alliances have actually happened before. Like it's not a new thing for you know, the young urban dispossessed people and farmers to you know, sort of get together. And you know, I think one of the reasons why I suppose the IFA and organizations like that would give out to poor Saoirse a lot is because she straddles that line of, you know, urban dispossessed person, but also someone who is from rural Ireland and is living in rural Ireland, and you know, you can't get more rural than Achill Island, you know. No offense. I think that's why organizations like, you know, who have this conservative kind of agenda in the keep things the same kind of sense, like, are so threatened. Because like those sort of you know, where the two sort of groups kind of converge, like you can see some really sort of crazy shit happen. I mean, like, you know, the Limerick Soviet was like, you know, urban workers, dispossessed kind of people, but like they wouldn't have actually lasted as long, except the farmers in Clare were the ones who were feeding them the whole time. And then at a similar, you know, on a similar kind of vein, I mean, like, you know, you had Soviets out in Brewery, you had these kind of, you know, like groups of people who wouldn't normally interact. Like, even if you look at like the US as well, like, you had, like, you know, organizations like Greenback or Greenback Labour, you know, who were those two groups, like, coming together and actually speaking for and with each other. So I think that's kind of part of it, like, that there's very much sort of vested interests who wouldn't want an alliance like that to happen, because it's such a powerful sort of thing, you know, like, and that's kind of what they're sort of guarding against.
I think as well, it's interesting to look at it in terms of the development of the state as well. And John, you know, you mentioned that the sins of the father, it's like, and gender plays a massive role as well. Like, most of the land, only 10% of land in Ireland is owned by women, like farming land. And there's it's something, it's interesting. It's with all the kind of talk of repeal and like work on, you know, with more women on corporate boards, there's rarely, if ever, any conversation around, well, who owns most of the land? And if land ownership was so strong in Irish culture and Irish, like Irish farming, as Conor McCabe kind of outlines, then why is it that where's the role of women in that? And I'll I'll just quickly read a bit here from Conor McCabe's book, Sins of the Father, which is just brilliant. And he basically kind of outlines the role of the live cattle exporters. So he calls them kind of the comprador or the ranchier class. And basically from colonization, as yourself and as Fergal and Saoirse stated, that we were, and John as well, that we were discouraged as a state from developing an industrial centre. That instead we were focused on a modern industrial assembly line, one which stretched for hundreds of miles from the smallholders of Sligo to the slaughterhouses of Deptford, and one for which the cattle ranchers supplied the raw material. The graziers did not produce beef. They did not produce shelf-ready products. They exported livestock to British fatteners and slaughterhouses, and it was there that the products which ended up on the kitchen table were made. This system of production had deep historical roots, so much so that all attempts to disentangle the Irish economy from such a lopsided relationship as one which saw calves on grass as a ne plus ultra of agricultural and industrial ambition were completely frustrated up until the 1950s, at which stage the importation of foreign industry was put forward as a seemingly perfect partner to the livestock business. So he kind of tracks the obsession with Irish FDI and foreign direct investment, which was the kind of, he calls it like the third way, that instead of Ireland developing its own industrial centre and instead of Ireland kind of tackling this grazier or rancher class, which was, you know, really kind of a result of the death of the spalping or the emigration of hundreds of agricultural workers during the, after the Great Famine, that they were mainly that their land was then taken up by these kind of the farmers that managed to have a bit more money that they could do so. And the third way was not to tackle them and not to tackle the large ranchers and not to build our own industrial base, but instead attract already fully developed businesses to Ireland. And that's where we have this present day issue of kind of large pharmaceutical companies, company today we see with data, kind of Twitter and so on. And this really interesting kind of dichotomy of like a highly material kind of industry in terms of farming, you know, which is very kind of hands on and you can feel the ground and you can see the impact of that farming in terms of the damage to our waters and the kind of the spread of forestry in terms of Sitka spruce as well. But then you have this like very interesting immaterial culture where in economics, where you have kind of huge growth in data, you have a huge growth in industries which actually just facilitate like a lot of law in Ireland. There's a huge kind of industry in facilitating tax evasion. So a lot of in Dublin as well, you have a lot of lawyers, a lot of accountants, a huge industry there, which is just acting as kind of a funnel. It isn't actually the production of anything in Ireland. It's just the funneling of activities, which are all immaterial and kind of exist in the cloud, which I found really fascinating, this dichotomy of the two. And how do we like bring it back to what Talaith Beo is doing, or even Gary Glass, which is a group that's in near us in Carrow, or even what, you know, we have been doing, what farmers who, as you say, who are critical of the system have always been doing, people who didn't have, who could manage to scrape enough by, particularly in coastal areas, surviving off the sea, that they didn't have to emigrate or that they didn't have to starve. What can we do? And for me, I think gender plays a massive role here as well, because as just as we have that class kind of like fight of the urban kind of urban younger kind of workers kind of turned against the farmers and not allowed to work together, you also have the same thing happening with gender. You have this kind of there's people that like friends of mine who are from Tipperary who say that the male suicide rate is also so high because there's a culture of not leaving the farmland to a man unless he's married by a particular age, or that he has to take care of the elderly mother into his own old age until it's too late then to find a wife. And you have kind of elderly people who have 80 acres or even 100 acres bought up over time and no one to leave it to but a nephew who then sells it to a data centre. And that kind of, you know, that kind of culture of never leaving the farm to a woman, even if they, you know, would bring about kind of, you know, like Chagas did a really interesting study led by Anya McInwash, kind of looking at how women engage in kind of different types of farming, like whether it was organic, but kind of taking advantage of the fact that you didn't have to have one focus, one beef barren kind of production line, that you could work on llamas or that you could, you know, engage in kind of varied farming lifestyle. And that has actually been proven by Chagas or Anya McInwash's research in NUIG in particular, that is actually a better way of doing it.
We've made a conscious choice in Talib Bio to include women in the board. So we have a core group, which is 12 people, and it's 6 men, 6 women. And it's definitely brought so much to the organization. It's just changed the whole perspective, I think, for a lot of people. And it was interesting just to see the reaction from different people that we've met, you know, because they're not used to meeting women farmers or hearing the voices of women farmers. And I mean, we have a kind of running joke which talks about the Farmer's Journal, because the Farmer's Journal, and it's one of the guys who gets it every week, and he says, you know, that there's the Farmer's Journal, and then there's the kind of Women's Farmer's Journal, which is the country living section in the middle of the Farmer's Journal.
Yeah, it's really good.
It's good. And he wrote a letter last week to them saying, like, you know, oh, well, you know, you why wouldn't you put in, you know, there's something about like the One Straw Revolution or something in the women's section of the country's journal. He goes, you'd never include that in the main section. It'd be too revolutionary for the men. It was just funny, but it's true. There is this kind of gender is a huge thing in Irish agriculture and a very untapped area, I think, that needs kind of much more reflection. Just one thing that just occurred to me when you read out the Conor McCabe piece, and it's kind of important because what he's talking about there was this kind of the line of cattle leaving the smallholder and being fattened in England. And I suppose it's one of the great victories for the Irish state that those cattle aren't fattened in England anymore. They're fattened in Ireland. And that's why they are constantly referred to it as an indigenous industry, because essentially that was, I suppose, a great victory for the Irish elite to say, well, you know, here's a product that we were losing the major chunk of the money on by exporting it half cooked or half ready to go and having somebody adding value at the end. And so we'll add value to it and we'll create our own kind of... And I suppose that's really what's happened. So, like, I mean, there are Goodmans of the... Which is amazing we haven't mentioned his name up until now, but we have now, so that's good. Larry Badman, as some of us like to call him. But Larry Goodman, you know, is the epitome of that. Like, I mean, he's kind of the, you know, he scored a great victory in some respects by developing or being at the head of an indigenous Irish industry, which, you know... I suppose you could consider an evolution on what was there before. And it is, in some respects, if you're going to be selling all those cattle, better to sell them at premium rates. You know, it's unfortunate that now they're all going into McDonald's burgers and the like, or whatever it might be, because they're just selling them on the global market. And one of the things that we would always say about the production is that, like, I mean, instead of focusing on that mass commodity market, there should be a focus on the kind of some sort of quality led thing, and I think the Irish state has tried to say that it's doing that through like its board beer greenwashing and Origin Green and lots of different programs which pertain to kind of, you know, explain how green Irish beef is and dairy, etc. But I think that's just a big greenwashing exercise. But I think that thing about the indigenous industry is important because it is like a little kind of one-up for the Irish state. And that probably occurred, you know, over the course of the last 50 years up until the turn of the century.
But it is still mad because, like, that's what most of the cattle farming around Connemara would be if there is cattle farming, if it's not sheep. And, I mean, it is quite crazy that you go to, you know, the local butcher and it isn't actually local beef. That, again, it's this, you know, all the cattle that's fattened goes to Larry Goodman, goes to kind of, you know, already very wealthy parts of the country, huge tracts of land. Well, you know, so
that's something that we really want to explore is the local food systems, because I mean they've been so badly eroded. They were ignored and then kind of derided, and I mean you have to remember that, like, local things, like, there was even a transition from eating like things like butter to eating margarine. There was the creation of byproducts of the industrial food model were kind of given precedence over things that have been made and would have been made, you know, 5 kilometers from where you lived. And so, like, that whole process has also happened at the same time now. And it's, again, it's a little bit that embracing modernity. It's like saying this is better because it's new, and it's, you know, it's the way things are done now. And, like, you know, I think we have this kind of a little bit that sense that, oh, we want to be seen to be doing things in the modern way, in the correct way. And not having enough faith in how what we might have had around us, and like and always looking back and thinking, oh yeah, we've moved on from that, as opposed to saying maybe there's something to learn back there after all, you know. And it's a shame that a lot of them have been so badly eroded that there's hardly anything left of them. But, like, I mean, I think their revival is something very interesting, and what I would hope to see is that they don't become, and at the moment they're kind of like what you see, the majority of local produce ends up in kind of the hands of people who have maybe more disposable income, maybe have more access to information, or it's shops which sell it, etc. And that's partly also because there's no support for people who are producing it. So, like, I mean, it is much harder, and I say that as a local food producer myself, you know, who wants to be able to charge a fair price for my produce because I'm getting no support from the state to produce it, to make a living from local food production. But it's also very difficult to make a living from producing for global commodity markets. The difference is that the people producing for the global commodity markets are getting a big sum of money from the taxpayer. And so the question is, why does the Irish state fund a model which produces for the export market and not fund something for its own citizens and the people that live on the island? And that's the question that we're trying to ask with Tala Bio and say, there's never, you know, there's your contradiction in terms of, like, agricultural food policy in the island of Ireland in a nutshell, you know?
That's a great question to be exploring, because, like, you know, I think that kind of cuts to the heart of it. Like, but I mean, what do you think then about, you know, sort of the way that local produce, you know, for better or worse, and let me know if I'm misspeaking here, but, like, you know, when I'm going down to the market here to go and get something, like, I'm not going down to the market to get something from a local person. Like, as far as my parents are concerned, I'm off down to the marché now to go and pick up some local brie, and, you know, like, what do you think about that?
It's, again, it's just, it's going to the supermarket is an acceptable way of, you know, maybe it's what we've created. It's something we've created, and we have to recreate a new way again. You know, we also need more production going into those markets, because, I mean, it's a volume issue as well, where, I mean, even around me here, I mean, there used to be fields of cabbages and spuds and onions that had been grown by local people to sell into local shops, to sell, you know, in the markets maybe. They're just not there anymore. So, like, if the volume's not there, it becomes more niche. It becomes more marginalized. You know, the market has changed. You know, the market is still in the old place where it used to be, which is, like, down a back street, which maybe back in the day was the whole street for the whole length of the street. Now it's like 5 traders. You know, give us an indoor place that we can trade, you know, where people go. Put us in front of the supermarket. Give us an indoor shop and a shelter in front of the supermarket to trade in. You know what I mean? And let people decide, to have their choice or whatever. And I have no doubt that they would come and buy more stuff or whatever. But, I mean, it's There's all sorts of issues there that need to be addressed. And I mean, we're trying to develop this local food policy framework in Tálibh Beo, which kind of looks at all those issues. And the other big issue is labor, because I mean, the kind of food production we're talking about is probably more labor intensive. Now, that's not necessarily a bad thing. I mean, I think, you know, those things could be looked at as advantageous in some respects, you know, in terms of providing livelihoods, providing kind of, activities for people as well. Because, I mean, you know, we've also got that kind of cultural conception that it's dirty or hard work. Mm. I mean, the amount of people that used to say to me, oh, it must be such hard work. And I go, yeah, it is hard work, but it's also hard work to sit in a call center or to sit behind a computer for 8 or 10 hours a day. And like, I mean, there's huge rewards to be gotten out of, you know, working outside and working with the land that, you know, maybe don't come from those things. It's also incredibly more pleasurable to work with other people on any kind of thing outside, be it if any kind of farming activity is better in two and better again in three. You know what I mean? And it's just, it shouldn't be a lonely profession. It should be something that we can all celebrate and enjoy. And why not have, and there's a great book which came out recently. I'll just give it a plug actually, because I think it synthesizes an awful lot of what we've talked about. And it's just called Small Farm Future. It's by a guy from the UK called Chris Smadge. I think he pronounced his name, S-M-A-J-E. And it really just tries to sort of say, look, if we're going to move forward as human beings on planet Earth, we need a kind of some sort of model which doesn't frighten people, which isn't kind of, you know, repressive, which allows people to celebrate the kind of their individuality if they want to, but also gives them a sort of source of sustenance and community coherence. And that might be a small farm future. And in Ireland is relatively well placed to embrace a lot of the things that he talks about in that book. And it's just a case of getting more people onto the land and beginning to build up those links. And I mean, for the cities, it's about looking at the hinterland, and it's about looking at a city of Dublin and saying, Dublin is sitting on top of the best growing area in the entire country, which is North Dublin, which is the best soils and climate for growing in possibly the whole of Ireland. And how much of that production, and I've talked to farmers up there who have just reduced and narrowed and narrowed and narrowed and narrowed their production down to one crop for one contract with a supermarket who breaks the contract, and they end up dumping articulated lorries worth of Brussels sprouts, and that's the absurdities created by that system. So like, that land should be feeding the people of Dublin first and foremost. And like, I mean, there's no reason why it couldn't if it was just organized in a different way. And so like, those are all the kind of things that we all need to talk about and explore, and the people of Dublin need to sit down and go, hang on, let's go and let's have a good look at the land around us. And that all towns should be looking at the land around them and saying, well, you know, this isn't just about zoning this area for development and see how much money we can make from whacking up 100 houses or whatever it might be. But surely there's room here where we can, you know, provide for ourselves and, you know, all the things that the land can offer.
I was hoping earlier on, Fergal, you'd be the first person to use a bad word that wasn't Larry Goodman. It's okay to say fuck on this podcast. And the point,
did I say fuck?
You didn't, but you were almost going to where it was the point you were saying there were some people who own land who don't give a fuck, but you used an alternative phrase. Well, it's okay to say fuck, so there now, said it three times.
Okay, good. I'm glad that's correct.
That's all right. And I think just to go back to something both Lorna and Sinead said, you know, part of what we're talking about here is, you don't know me, Fergal, but I'm an old Marxist at heart. And the hammer and the sickle was always an alliance between workers and farmers. And I do think we're going to have to start looking at a new alliance as we build a sustainable, you know, livelihood producing, quality of life and life affirming food system, which would be the aspiration, I think, for many of us on this call, and perhaps for many of our listeners. And for me, listening to you, I do think we have to seriously address that perhaps what we're facing is a new round of decolonization. Last time it was the British Empire. Now I think, you know, it's either the EU, globalization, corporatization, commoditization, that these need to be new struggles that I think Tálibh Beo, what you're talking about, it seems to be part of that long tradition of agrarian-based defense of life and locality. And you know, in many respects. And I do think that issue of food security and food sovereignty, that we often think that somehow like the Via Campesina, oh, that's for people in South America and Africa. Actually, no, it's for everybody. It's for everywhere in the world, that we should be growing food locally. You know, a bit like energy. Energy and food are the two things you absolutely want to have as locally produced as possible, because, you know, once you have global supply chains, you're very vulnerable and also vulnerable to, you know, exploitation. So I do think there's something around that relocalization, the re-indigenization, the, you know, the valuing of local knowledge, as both yourself and Sinead has said, and to encourage. Now, again, taking into account Saoirse's point, that we can't just romantically think that anybody who owns a piece of land knows what they have to do, which is why a big issue, and maybe this is me pitching for when we come on to P in the ABCs of green politics, we look at property rights and land. I think in a sustainability context, that the idea of property rights as being the exclusive control of one or whoever has that property right is ecologically irrational. Because the impacts of the use and abuse of that land goes beyond that particular, you know, bounded property area. You know, quite in my view, property rights and land are a temporary gift of the community to an individual to use that particular property sustainably and responsibly. And but ultimately, though, it's for the community to decide how that land should be used. There's a big issue there about, I think, reconfiguring property rights and land in the age of the planetary crisis, which, of course, is a big philosophical legal issue. And, of course, Sinead, our resident, not only Batman movie aficionado, but also our legal eagle, may want to have some comments on that when we come on to it. But the last point I'd make, because many of us on the this podcast are members of the Just Transition Greens. And I think on the island of Ireland, I live in Northern Ireland, you know, the whole idea of a just transition is often seen around what are we going to do with displaced, you know, oil workers or coal workers as we make the transition. We don't have, you know, there was the issue of Bordnamona in the Midlands and so on. But on the island of Ireland, our just transition struggle as we create a life-affirming, sustainable economy is going to be in our rural communities, because those contemporary agricultural systems we have are utterly unsustainable. Farmers have been incentivized, as you said, to grow grass-fed beef for export and so on. It's not their fault, but we're going to have some difficult conversations with our farming communities about a different model. And that's why I think you're a pioneer, Fergal, in a way, trying to, you know, and it can be lonely because you're like John the Baptist rather than Jesus. You're the one doing the hard graft and sowing seed.
They didn't cut his head off.
Yeah, don't worry. You know, it all came good in the end. The point is that we do need to have folk like yourself with support to, you know, demonstrate that a different way of farming and making a good living doesn't have to be at the expense of either exploitation of labour. And there's a whole issue we didn't get into, and something I'm very acutely aware here in the North, that the amount of exploited Eastern European labour factory farms in terms of chicken production, mushrooms and so on, that if anyone's listening to this who doesn't get what I have to say, is that if a food product is cheap, it's cheap for either one or two reasons. The land has been exploited, or the person who made that piece of food or has been exploited. That, to me, is the essence of, you know, what we're talking about here, about the need to move beyond a carbon-based, you know, agricultural system. But ultimately, we have to move beyond a capitalist-based one, that we have to actually begin to have a different view of the land as commons, as food security and localising food production as much as possible. And for me, I'm certainly going to read more about your work, Fergal, and I think you're a pioneer, and I'm hoping that we look back on, you know, what's happening at the moment, that this current moment of the pandemic, and the point you made about, there's more jobs to be had in perhaps a different non-industrial food system. Well, bring it on, because as we come out of the pandemic, we're going to need more jobs. You know, that's what we need. It's not growth. Is actually jobs. And I think therefore the model you're proposing is absolutely what we need. So listen, great to talk to you, and it's been inspirational. I was a bit tired coming in tonight. I had loads of Zoom calls, but actually I'm energized now. I'm reconnecting like the bull McCabe in the field. I'm reconnecting with the land.
And just fetch the pipe, John.
Thanks, Natasha.
Fetch down the pipe.
I have, just before we go, I have a few points to make. One was that you were talking there, Fergal, at one stage, you were saying like our connection with, I can't remember how you were putting it, our connection with the land has been eroded so much. And I do think what will happen or what has to happen or will maybe happen coincidentally with us kind of maybe reassessing how we interact with the land will be a redevelopment of an Irish food culture, because ours is so thoroughly fragmented. I think, you know, that being what you farm for, it was really easy to lose how you farm once we lost our food, once our food culture was completely dismantled. Like if you look at a place, look at how much dairy we produce and look at our cheese, you know, variety. And there are definitely small cheeses being made in different places, but like compared to a place like France, you would think with our proportion to dairy cattle, of dairy cattle to people, it would be huge, but our, it's like we never held, we couldn't hold, it's like we couldn't hold on to a particular food culture. Secondly, I was just going to say, and this in terms of marketing, feel free to use this, Fergal, you don't even have to cite me. In terms of what John was saying there, it does feel like, it's like, you know, the Land League was fighting landlords and rack rent, but they didn't fight landlordism. And I think that is now what you have to do. The like continuing that role of the Land League, of but expanding it to, because it does feel like in a lot of cases, like the Irish got the land and were like, right, we're here now, we're in charge. And much like Larry Goodman, you know, fattening everyone's cattle now instead of somewhere in Derbyshire or wherever you said, it's like landlordism has to be kind of rooted out of Ireland. And third, and now depending on where everyone falls on this, I think the idea of a, like the whole conversation that will happen around a united Ireland as to whether it happens or not, I think will be really fertile ground for reimagining how we interact with our land, because physically our land was never divided. Geographically, it never was. And so it being legally brought back together or not, or even talked about, I think there'll be great space in that conversation for what do we want our interaction with our land to look like. And that's all I have to say. And thanks a million for joining us. And anyone else, any final words?
I just want to say quickly, because like this is something actually that I started work with Amy Strecker. So she's a professor in UCD. And her work is on the right to a landscape. And it's absolutely fascinating work. What the term landscape actually used to mean was the right of kind of a polity or like a community itself to like a community's way of living with the land and operating the land, not only in terms of kind of like aesthetic kind of beauty, which is what, you know, landscape means today, but also in terms of like how the democratic kind of functions work within that community, and also how the land is kind of shared like and worked on together. And in many, it comes mainly from like Dutch areas, which kind of farmed a lot of the land in common. But like what her project is doing is like, so like it's fascinating. I was looking, her work is kind of like on the indigenous people's rights in international law are really, really strong in terms of protecting that kind of right to a landscape, as she calls it, which is like the right of a community to kind of operate as a whole in communion with their land, but in a way that's kind of inclusive and not kind of like scary blood soil, you know. And what I found was fascinating, because like I did, you know, having gotten involved in the project, I started looking at kind of First Nations peoples, particularly in the US, and how they operate is that the land is owned by kind of the reservation and its democratic processes. But it is then kind of worked on kind of in a commonage manner. And I just found that kind of like absolutely fascinating. It for me, it's kind of like what Foucault calls like a heterotopia. So it's probably not a utopia. I'm sure there's lots of problems with it. But it's certainly kind of another way of seeing land and operating land. And these kind of sites are kind of a place that we can build new ideas of resistance, and in a way that respects, obviously, Indigenous peoples and only builds up their work and their campaigns to protect the land in their own way. What is it that we could learn in terms of building a right to a landscape in Ireland? Is there a way that we could have, like, what would Tall of Beo and those conceptions work as in terms of a right of a community to its landscape in a holistic sense? You know, as you said, like, these kind of terms of property ownership and, like, individualistic, atomistic kind of individual owning plots of land was used by the United States to try and undermine the reservations. They parceled out land in kind of a land commission way to kind of First Nations people. And then they said, well, if there's any left over, we can give that to, you know, the local farmer or the kind of pioneers or people who kind of are coming into the area, kind of white settlers. And so it's interesting too that the Land Commission, I know it's always kind of presented in Ireland as like this super positive thing. In many ways it was, but what did it do to the kind of like underlying ways of ownership that might have kind of existed before the famine or before colonization as well? And yeah, how do we kind of return to that? So yeah, hopefully that new round of decolonization, as you said, John Barry, is like really, really interesting. I definitely think we're kind of coming into one.
The Zapatistas have a saying, which was, we're walking slowly because we're going a long way. And I think in some ways that's how I feel about this, because I don't think it's from one day to the next that we're going to see, you know, an agrarian revolution in Ireland, unfortunately, even as interesting and all as that would be. But I think, you know, the first thing that we kind of need to relearn is how to organize ourselves and how to work together. And I think it's something that I see just in movements, and I see it in kind of, you know, and I see it in the people and groups that I'm involved with, that I think, in a, you know, this atomized, individualized society has made it harder for people to effectively kind of work together and organize together and associate with each other and do things in effective ways together. And sort of, and I don't want to mean this in any kind of sacrificial, like blood-like way, but to sacrifice their own kind of individual importance for the kind of good of the whole or the movement or what we need to do. And I think that it's actually one of our oldest strengths as human beings is that capacity to see beyond our own individuality. And it's something that we can get out of touch with, and we've gotten out of touch with. And if we can get back in touch with that, we'll be a lot closer to getting back in touch with all the other things which you mentioned there, which were those kind of touch with the land, touch with those things, because ultimately human beings are things that we have all around us that we need to reconnect with. And maybe now, after the pandemic, more than ever, we need to reconnect with other human beings and say, oh, well, how can we do things better together?
Pints on Tall of Beo.
Very nice to speak to you all.
Well, thanks a million for joining us. I think that's it. And I'm sure now everyone will be sharpening their pikes. And
I've got a few spare.
Yeah, there you go.
We can all get Mice Hell t-shirts. Because they already have the t-shirts that it's got a picture of a pike on it. And then it says Slum Lords Out. Iconography is nice. Already there. Nice. Yeah, so that's what we wear.
How do you even find that? Were you just Googling pike t-shirts?
No, I have one. I have one already. But
me too. Yeah,
they'll have to go. They'll have to go and print some more.
Michelle Russell, she's amazing.
Episode ever. Like, so many things now that we've bought. Like,
but I can't let this episode go without mentioning and quoting the wonderful Chico Mendes that many would know, who said, "Environmentalism without class struggle is gardening, and we're not interested in gardening." So hopefully people who've listened to take some inspiration from that. I mean, it's part of an Irish tradition that from the land, the good things come. And we're not that far away from it at all. So it's been absolutely inspirational, Fergal. So, Gnarly an tá leat.
Good morning.
Thank you.